Our guest is award-winning novelist and essayist Amos Oz. He's the author of more than 20 books, including fiction, nonfiction, a memoir, and three for children. He was born in 1939 in what would become the State of Israel and has lived there ever since. He's the most well-known Israeli writer working today, and his books have been translated into many languages, including Arabic. His new book, Scenes from Village Life, is about people living in a small town surrounded by fields and orchards called Tel Ilan. It was founded by pioneers a century ago and is undergoing a transformation. The stories are about daily life and also about something deeper and more unsettling. Amos Oz says it's about people who've lost something and they go searching for it. In fact, they search for something they've kept hidden from themselves. Amos Oz joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. It's a great pleasure. Thank you for stopping by Philadelphia and being a guest today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. The title of your book is taken from Anton Chekhov's play, Uncle Vanya.
That's right.
How so? Why?
Well, Chekhov is a great influence in my life. He taught me the significance of small-time people and small-time events. And I very often write about small-time people and small-time events, although I come from a very dramatic part of the world.
Yes, you do. When did you start reading Chekhov? How old were you?
In my teen years. I read him in wonderful Hebrew translations, as I cannot read Russian. But I always felt he was writing about our neighborhood.
And fell in love with him when you first read him?
Fell in love with him when I first read him because I felt I knew the characters personally.
I also read that Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio, was also an influence on your writing. How so?
Oh, this book had a great influence on me. When I was 16, an aspiring writer, I thought I'll never become a writer because I'm in a catch. You cannot be a writer unless you live in a big city like New York or Paris or London, and you cannot afford to go to live in one of those cities unless you are a famous writer. So it was a catch-22. Then I read Winesburg, Ohio by Sherwood Anderson in a Hebrew translation, and he opened my eyes to realize that for a writer, the center of the universe is right where you are.
This book is about a small village, Tel Ilan. How would you describe it to our listeners?
It's one of the half a dozen or two dozen old Jewish villages in Israel, much older than the state of Israel, twice as old as the state of Israel. And those villages are undergoing a great change now. They are, on the one hand, dilapidating and even decomposing as agricultural communities, but rejuvenated as weekend resorts with galleries and restaurants and wine boutiques. So they have new life. But my stories are mostly about the old life, the old time people, the old families.
A form of gentrification, I guess, as we see in this country and other countries around the world as well.
A form of gentrification, that's right.
Did you have a certain town in mind when you created Tel Ilan?
In fact, Tel Ilan was born out of a dream.
Was it?
6 or 7 years ago, before I started writing this book, I dreamt one night that I'm in one of those old Jewish villages. Alone. The village was empty in my dream. No people, no dogs, no cats, no birds even. And I was looking for somebody. And in the middle of the dream, as it happens in dreams sometimes, it was no longer me looking for somebody, but some people looking for me and me trying to hide. When I woke up, I knew that my next book is going to be set in one of those villages. Not a specific one in mind, but just one of those old, dilapidating villages.
Do you often have vivid dreams like that?
I have dreams and I have nightmares, both.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
I mean, ones that you remember?
Very often I remember my dreams. Well, I have made myself a point to try not to forget my dreams because sometimes the seed for a new story is in a dream.
Including this story as well.
Including this story, this book as well.
And one of the things, and I quoted this, that you say about the people living in this village, in this town, they search for something they've kept hidden from themselves, which is very provocative. I mean, I'm curious how you think about that.
This is very much a book about half knowing, about half remembering. Sometimes it's about half touching. I think it's a basic human condition. We all are in the state of half-knowing and half-remembering, a déjà vu feeling, a sense of familiarity, a sense of remote knowledge or remote remembrance. All the characters in Scenes from Village Life, are searching for something they hid from themselves. A fact of life, an event, a memory, something they have suppressed.
There's also this sound of digging, you know, that seems to permeate this town as well. People don't know, they think someone else is digging. They're not sure who's doing the digging, but they hear digging sounds.
Don't we all hear sounds on sleepless nights?
Yeah. Is that what you hear, digging sounds?
All kinds of sounds, yes.
You were interviewed by Robert Siegel about this book, and you said it was about, and I wrote this all down, about love, loss, loneliness, longing, death, desire, desolation, and disillusionment.
Yes.
That's kind of life itself, is it not?
Well, these are stories about human life. They were read by some of my critics in Israel as an allegory about the Israeli condition. I think this is a waste of a reading. These are not stories about Israeli politics. These are not stories about Israelis and Palestinians. These stories are not trying to compete with the CNN world. They are stories about the human condition, about the great and simple things in life, love and loss and loneliness, death and desire and desolation.
Do you get frustrated that since you're an Israeli writer, everyone thinks that your writing is an allegory for the conflict, and you're looking at me like, oh my God, here we go again?
You know, I'm philosophical about it. A writer who lives in a troubled part of the world is destined to be interpreted as always making a statement about the state of the nation in disguise. If I wrote a little story about father, mother, daughter, and pocket money, some of my readers will assume that the father is the Palestinians, the mother is the Jews, the pocket money is the bad economy, and the daughter is the young generation. What can I do?
Well,
I think it's a waste of a reading.
A waste of a reading.
Yes.
Are you resigned to it, though? I mean, this is just sort of the fact of being a novelist in this part of the world?
Well, I can't tell my readers how to read me. I can't be present when they read the book. But I would say this again and again. If you read everything as an allegory on Israelis and Palestinians, or as an allegory on West Bank settlements, or as an allegory about the Arab Spring, you are wasting a literary reading.
Well, I would love to have you read a section from your book.
Yeah. This is from the story Digging. As the end of his life approached, Pesach Kedem, the former member of the Knesset, lived with his daughter Rachel on the edge of the village of Tel Ilan in the Menashe Hills. He was a tall, vituperative man with a hunched back. On account of kyphosis, his head was thrust forward almost at a right angle. At 86 years of age, he was gnarled and sinewy. His skin reminded you of the bark of an olive tree, and his tempestuous temperament made him seem to be boiling over with strongly held ideas and opinions. All day long he potted around the house in his slippers, wearing an undershirt and a pair of khaki trousers that were too loose on him and were held up by braces. He invariably wore a shabby black beret that came halfway down his forehead, which made him look like a tank commander put out to grass. And he never stopped grumbling. He swore at a drawer that refused to open, cursed a newscaster who muddled Slovakia and Slovenia, railed at the westerly wind that wiped up suddenly and scattered his papers on the veranda table, and shouted at himself because when he bent down to pick them up, he bumped into the corner of the table as he stood up. He had never forgiven his party for falling apart and disappearing 25 years earlier. He was pitiless in his criticism of his opponents and enemies, all of them long since deceased. The younger generation, electronics and modern literature, all earned his disgust. The newspapers published nothing but filth. Even the men who presented the weather forecast on television seemed to him like an arrogant matinee idol who mumbled nonsense and had no idea what he was talking about.
That's Amos Oz reading from one of the chapters in his new book, the book called Scenes from Village Life. I have to say, I love this character. I mean, he's so angry, he's so irascible, he's so frustrated with the world that he sees around him.
I wanted him to be terrible and lovable at the same time. He is terrible and lovable.
Was he fun to write?
He was fun to write, although not easy. I didn't want to create a stereotype. I wanted to create a living man with his weaknesses and his strong points.
But do you think he represents a certain kind of generation, and not just someone in Israel, but an older person that has been part of a struggle, looks around them, the world has changed, they don't understand everything, people have disappointed them?
Well, bear in mind that Israel was born out of a dream. Unlike other countries born out of demography and geography and politics and history, Israel was born out of a dream. Everything that is born out of a dream is destined to be a disappointment. Mm. The only way to keep a dream rosy and perfect and intact is never to try to live it out. This is true of every dream. This is true of writing a novel or traveling abroad or even living out a sexual fantasy. And this man, Pesach Kedem, the old man, he is one of the members of the generation of the great dreamers. Mm. No wonder Israel is a disappointment to him. This disappointment is not about the nature of Israel. It's about the nature of dreams.
The dreams will disappoint.
Yeah, if they come true.
They come true, exactly, just to add to the complexity. Yeah. You've written many books. Do you struggle as a writer? And by that, I mean, does it ever get easier over time?
On the contrary, it's becoming harder and harder. Unlike
right?
a carpenter or a hairdresser who becomes more fluent with experience, for me, trying not to write the same book again after 27 books, it's very, very hard mm-hmm. to invent something new. This, for example, Scenes from a Village Life, is a novel in stories. It's a new form. I call it a novel in stories because characters move freely from one story to the next, because all the characters know one another. And in one of the stories, most of them even converge in the same house under yeah. the same roof for yeah. a singing event.
But for you to, I know this was published a couple of years ago in
yes.
Israel. When did you start writing this?
I started writing this about 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Took a long time to travel into English.
It did. And when you say it's hard to write, and we're almost up in a break here, does that mean that you struggle over words, over phrases, over characters, over a fresh story
Every
idea?
Word is a struggle. Every adjective, every adverb is a struggle because my mantra is precision.
Mm. Precision.
Precision.
That it must be correct, precise.
Must be the right word and a fresh word. Not just the right word, but also a fresh word.
And that's Amos Oz, our guest today in Radio Times, one of Israel's most acclaimed authors. He is the author of how many books did you say?
27.
27 books. And he has a new one called Scenes from Village Life. It's about a small village that was founded about 100 years ago mm-hmm. by pioneers in Israel. And it's about life inside this town, but also a sense that the world is changing around them, and also a sense that something is not quite right. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Hill School supports WHYY. A private co-educational boarding school located in Pottstown, the Hill School provides students in grades 9 through 12 with the essentials for college, careers, and life in a diverse learning and living community. Hill students come from across the country and around the world. They are athletes, artists, friends, classmates, and future leaders. An open house is October 29th at 9:30 a.m. Information is available at 610-326-1000 or online at thehill.org.
Newsworks.org is your source for smart stories that keep you better informed, better connected, and better prepared. Our network of quality journalists is a step above the rest, and better coverage of important issues means you'll always be a step ahead. Newsworks is something different. News for people who ask more. News for people who care, by people who care. Get involved at Newsworks.org. Newsworks is, simply, news that works. Powered by WHYY and you.
JerseyArts.com supports WHYY, featuring details on American Repertory Ballet's presentation of The Nutcracker, November 25th through December 18th at McCarter Theater, Patriots Theater at the War Memorial, TD Bank Arts Center, and State Theater, New Jersey. A full schedule of performances and events at arballet.org. American Repertory Ballet, and more online at jerseyarts.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Amos Oz, one of Israel's most acclaimed writers. His books have been translated into many languages. He's received numerous honors and awards. His new book is called Scenes from Village Life, set in a small 100-year-old pioneer farming community in Israel that's being developed. It's being suburbanized. He explores some of the inner struggles of the residents against a backdrop of daily life and a sense that something is amiss. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. This book is translated, as many of your books have been, by Nicholas DeLange. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. And this is a translator that you have worked with, is that the right word?
Yes.
Okay. For what? More than 40 years now?
42 years, yes.
How did you find, or how did Nicholas DeLange find you, or how did you find him?
Well, I spent a sabbatical in Oxford, England in 1969, and he was a postgraduate student of theology, and I wrote a story about the Crusaders, and he wanted to read it, and I told him the story is in Hebrew, and he said, that's no problem. I gave him the story to read, and he came back to me 2 weeks later with a rather flawed English translation of the first few paragraphs. I was so impressed by his command of English that I said, I'm going to have this man as my translator if he agrees, even if I have to sit with him and explain every Hebrew word. By now, he has a perfect command of Hebrew, and he is probably the best translator of Hebrew into English.
And he has translated all your books?
He has translated almost all my books, yes.
And you send it to him? And the reason I ask is, and clearly your command of English is excellent.
My English is just good enough to tell him when I think he is wrong.
I was wondering about that.
Sometimes he will come up with two or three or four or five alternative idioms for a certain Hebrew idiom. He will vote everything and ask me, and I vote everything, I will veto everything, and he will ask me, so what is the English for this and that? And I'll smile and say, English is your department, sir, not mine.
It doesn't seem fair somehow.
Yeah, but he's a wonderful translator. He is, I think, the best translator of Hebrew into English.
I came across in this book, he uses the word higgledy-piggledy. Mm. I mean, that is in this book, and I thought, gosh, what's Hebrew? Higgledy-piggledy, what is that word?
It's an equivalent of a certain Hebrew idiom which is untranslatable literally, but it's a good equivalent. And I often think that translating a work of literature is like playing a violin concerto on the piano. It can be done very successfully on one strict condition. Never try to force the piano to produce the sounds of the violin. Which is why I say to all my translators, and I'm translated into 41 languages, I say to all of them, for God's sake, be unfaithful in order to be loyal. Look for an equivalent.
I remember interviewing someone whose books had also been translated, and his description was that he saw it as the underside of a rug. I mean, on the front of the rug, you know, a beautiful rug, obviously,
yes.
It's vivid colors.
Yes.
And on the underside, you get that, but not quite in its vivid form.
Well, there is a penalty for translation, especially translating Hebrew into English or any other European language, which is traveling a very long way. But a good translator compensates. He compensates. He finds an idiom in the target language which conveys the same feeling, the same emotion, the same response in the reader as the original expression in the original language, although it's not the same expression.
Your book has been some of your books have been translated into Arabic, and you were telling us that there's a Kurdish pirated...
Yes, I received a copy not long ago, a single copy of a pirated Kurdish edition of my tale of love and darkness.
Your memoir.
Yes.
That must make you feel pretty good.
Yes, I never expected to extract royalties from the Kurds. So, yes, it makes me feel good.
But if it's pirated, you're probably not getting a dime, right?
No.
And it has been translated, your books have been translated, some of them, into Arabic. Has that been a struggle?
That has been very exciting. Of all the many translations of my books, it's the Arabic translation that moves me most. I'll tell you a little story about the Arabic translation of A Tale of Love and Darkness. Mm. 7 or 8 years ago, a young Palestinian Israeli student was jogging in Jerusalem. He was shot in the head and murdered by terrorists who mistook him for a Jew. His loving family decided to finance the Arabic translation of A Tale of Love and Darkness in memory of their beloved son slain by terrorists who mistook him for a Jew, and in order to improve the understanding between the two peoples. Mm-hmm. This Arabic edition was published in Lebanon by a very courageous Lebanese publisher and distributed all over the Arab world to a chorus of voices ranging from "How dare you distribute this Zionist filth in the Arab world" to "We Arab writers should learn how to write such books."
Wow. And do you think that's what books can do?
That's what books can do.
Or should do, perhaps.
You know, books remove stereotypes. Books take us into the private lives of other peoples, into the bedroom and the living room and the nursery and the kitchen of other people.
I read somewhere, I guess this is talking about your life, that when you were a kid growing up in what became, I guess, Israel, is that you wanted to be a book.
Yes, life was so strained and so hazardous, and the future was so uncertain that I decided I'd rather grow up and become a book than become a man, because people are so easy to kill. Books are also easy to burn, but if I am a book, then a copy of me may survive somewhere in the library in Philadelphia.
And it was dangerous because, what, was this with the 40s? Or
it was the 40s. It was immediately after the Holocaust. And there was an immediate fear in Jewish Jerusalem that once the British pull out, there may be another Holocaust. The Arabs will come and slay all of us. So we lived practically between two Holocausts, or between a fear of another impending Holocaust.
And you were born in 1939.
That's right.
And grew up in Jerusalem?
In Jerusalem,
yes. Neighborhood in Jerusalem.
Yes, I'm 72 today, which is the equivalent of being a 356-year-old American. I am older than my state. I saw the Boston Tea Party with my own eyes. I shook hands with George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. Treat me with respect, please. You are talking to
a
sage. You are talking to a sage.
So you were older than your country.
I'm older than my country. Yes.
But you, in a sense, grew up together, yes?
Yes, I have seen it all. I have witnessed all of it.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Amos Oz, our guest today on Radio Times. And he is, as I've said several times, one of Israel's most acclaimed writers. He's written 27 books. The newest one is a collection of stories about a pioneer village. It's called Scenes from Village Life. And any questions or comments you might have, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Why? Let me ask you a couple more questions from your book. And one of the characters says, "Inside everyone, there is a child they once were." Mm-hmm. Something, frankly, I resonated with. But I'm interested in what that means to you.
I often look at an adult and I can see through the child he or she has once been. I can see the child. Sometimes it's a terrified child. Sometimes it's a playful child. Sometimes it's a very sad child. But I have developed the habit of looking at people and decoding the child they once were.
When you look in the mirror, do you see the child you once were?
Oh, I don't even have to look in the mirror. This child is very much alive. You know, half the people are carrying inside them a dead child, and the other half are carrying a living child inside them. And with me, the inner child is very much alive.
Mm. And a dead child means suffering, means despair, means loss.
Disillusionment.
Disillusionment,
yes.
Which is many ways you say this book is about disillusionment.
This book is very much about disillusionment, yes, among other things.
So are you depressed about the human condition?
Well, I know human condition is no joke.
What does that mean?
It means that we are surrounded by death and desolation. We are surrounded by loneliness. We are surrounded by loss and disillusionment. And at the same time, we search. And this search is the greatest hope in human life. In the characters in Scenes from Village Life never give up the search. Mm-hmm. They keep searching all the time.
I mean, that's the existential quest, is it not?
That's the existential quest, precisely.
I mean, to figure out what this is all about in spite of everything.
Yes, try to crave a meaning out of all this, carve a meaning out of all of this.
The mayor in one of these chapters gets a note from his wife saying, "Don't worry about me," which, of course, if you got a note from someone like that, you would worry about them, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
do you think about that? I mean, don't worry about me means, of course...
It's a terrible sentence.
It's a terrible sentence.
It's a horrible message to leave on the kitchen table. Terrible.
Right.
And he worries. Although to the very end of the story, the reader doesn't know if she had vanished for good, right, or, heaven forbid, killed herself, or just went to the next door neighbor for a chat. It remains open. These are open-ended stories, like life itself. The stories are open-ended.
It almost feels like a ghost story in a way.
Yeah.
Let me quote something else, and this is just pulling out a conversation between, is it Adele?
Adele.
He's an Arab living in this village, and a woman named Rachel. And Adele says, "Our happiness is partly our fault and partly your fault, but your unhappiness comes from your soul." She says, "Our soul?" He says, "Or from your heart. It's hard to know. It comes from you, from inside. The unhappiness, it comes from deep inside you."
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty powerful.
That's pretty... pretty genuine, yes.
Right. I mean, that the happiness comes from the soul.
Yeah. And the unhappiness, both the happiness and the unhappiness, right, yes.
And you chose those words very carefully, obviously.
Of course I did. Right. Of course I did.
And that feels true to you?
I have nothing to add to these words. They speak for themselves.
Which makes it hard for me to interview about these words. Let me ask you a little bit about your life. And you were born in 1939. Grew up in Jerusalem. Your family came from
Russia and the Ukraine.
Russian. When did they come to what became then the State of Israel?
1933-34, just before the Holocaust, right, in time.
In time.
Yeah.
And did they have a sense of impending doom?
They were driven out by violent anti-Semitism and discrimination against the Jews. They were forced into going to Jerusalem, fortunately for them, because if Europe had not kicked them out violently in the 1930s, it would have murdered them in the 1940s.
Mm. But to be kicked out, I mean, is to leave something behind, is it not?
They lived a life of unrequited life toward Europe. They loved Europe and hated Europe. They were angry with Europe and heartbroken about Europe. They fantasized about Europe all their life. They were Europeans at a time when no one else in Europe was a European. Mm-hmm. Today it's not a big deal. Wow. Everyone is a European, and those who are not European yet are standing in line to become Europeans. But 70 or 80 years ago, the only Europeans in Europe were Jewish people like my folks. No one else was a European. Everyone else was a Bulgarian patriot or an Irish patriot or a Norwegian patriot. And for being European, those Jews were labeled cosmopolitans, they were labeled ruthless intellectuals, they were labeled parasites. But they regarded themselves as Europeans, and they were the first Europeans.
Mm. So you feel like you're the son of European parents?
I am the son of exiled European parents, yes.
And forever that sense of exile?
Forever that sense of ambivalence toward Europe.
Right.
And we are, all of us, are either immigrants or children of immigrants. Mm. Israel is a refugee camp. Palestine is also a refugee camp. The clash between Jewish Israel and Arab Palestine is a tragic clash between two refugee camps.
So what were you like as a kid growing up in that house?
Well, I was bookish.
You liked books?
I was surrounded by books. Well, mind you, we had no television, we had no telephone, we had no radio, there were no computers. The only thing we had were books, and there was abundance of books in the house. My father could read 16 or 17 languages, and there were hundreds and hundreds of books piling in that tiny little apartment the size of a submarine.
Wow.
And it was everywhere, in the kitchen, in the bathroom, books, books, books. So I read. This was my world.
Did you have friends?
I had some friends, but it was difficult to keep friendships in Jerusalem because in British Jerusalem, a curfew was imposed on the city every evening.
How early?
6 o'clock.
Oh, 6 o'clock. Yeah. So no playing outside?
No playing outside. No playing outside, no seeing friends. Mm-hmm. And I was an only child, so I had only books.
You wrote about this in your memoir, but your mother committed suicide when you were just, 12 years old?
12 years old, yes.
Looking back, did you see a woman in despair suffering?
Looking back, yes, but at the time I didn't realize it. Mm-hmm. I was very angry with her for killing herself. I thought of her as if she ran off with a lover without leaving us a note. Mm-hmm. I was immensely angry with her. Mm-hmm. I was angry with my father for losing her. I was angry for myself because I thought if I were a good kid, she would have stayed. I was angry with everyone for a long time.
So why did she kill herself?
There is no simple answer to this. The 600 pages of A Tale of Love and Darkness are a search for the answer, and there is no one-line answer to this question.
Yeah. But something that haunts any family, it seems to me.
Yes. Well, you know, Tolstoy says that all happy families are the same. Each unhappy family is different.
Yeah. Does it feel like it was an unhappy family?
It was an unhappy family, yes. Mm. And that's what I write about all my life. If you ask me in one word what my 27 books are all about, I'll say families. Mm. If you gave me two words, I'll say unhappy families. If you gave me three words, you'll have to read my books.
I have a feeling you've said that before, but that's okay. Something else I read, and again, this goes back to your family, but that after your mother died, that your father and you never spoke of her.
Never. We erased her from our lives. Not a word. Not about her death, not about her life, as if she had never existed. As if she was a Soviet leader depersonized by Stalin and forgotten. For many years, I did not discuss my mother with anyone. I did not discuss my parents with my new family when I raised a family. It took me many, many years to open this story and start treating my parents as if they were my children.
Mm, like your children.
Which is what I did when I wrote A Tale of Love and Darkness. Mm. I treated my parents as if they were my children.
But did it feel like it was something you just could not say, or it just you erased that discussion from ever happening?
It was too painful to discuss. And besides, there was nothing to say. I didn't know why she killed herself. My father didn't know why she killed herself. Probably didn't know either. There was nothing to say.
Oh. But you have talked, you wrote about this, and I guess...
Of course. Well, my anger subsided and was replaced by compassion, curiosity, humor, and longing.
Yeah. But it's interesting to me that you turned your parents into children. So you became their parents in order to understand them?
In order to write about them, I had to become my parents' parent.
Yeah. Which happens with children, doesn't it?
Which happens with children, yes.
And your father, what happened to him?
He died quite young, at the age of 60 in 1970. But I still talk to him almost every day. We disagree on politics. We have vehement political debates every day, although he has been dead for 41 years now.
And do you win those arguments with your father?
You never win an argument with a father. Never. No one ever wins an argument with a parent.
Well, let's take another short break and we'll get back to our conversation. And Amos Oz is our guest today on Radio Times. And he's the author of many books. We're talking about a new one called Scenes from Village Life. He's been translated into many languages, received numerous awards and honors, and grew up in what became the State of Israel, and has been outspoken on a number of issues related to Israel and the Middle East. And obviously joining us today in Radio Times to talk about many things. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Oriental Rug Room at 10,000 Villages in Ephrata supports WHYY, featuring hand-knotted rugs made by fairly paid adults. Online at rugs.10000villages.com. 10,000 Villages. Quality you desire. Fairness artisans deserve.
To protect the life of a dog who is being abused, the hero of Scott Spencer's novel Man in the Woods gets into a fight and accidentally kills the man abusing the dog. In shock, he thinks,
"How can this be happening?" And he wishes, suddenly, fervently, that there was a God.
We'll hear from Scott Spencer on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Navigating the Medicare maze. Time is running out for seniors to adjust their benefits. And just in time for Halloween, the pseudoscience of a zombie brain. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
So supporting WHYY, Lincoln, presenting the new Lincoln MKX crossover, featuring Sync with My Lincoln Touch in-car connectivity system for voice commands. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, it's not just luxury, it's smarter than that.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Amos Oz, one of Israel's most acclaimed writers. He's got a new book called Scenes from Village Life. We've got open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Let me read something that you said in The New Yorker. This was a couple of years ago. It was a really wonderful profile of you. And you said the Jews and Arabs had the same oppressors. The Europeans were guilty of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust, and the Europeans were guilty of colonialism in the Middle East and the exploitation of the Arabs. That both Arabs and Israelis, as you say, had the same oppressors.
Yes, and you would have thought that two victims of the same oppressor become brothers. They hug each other and they march together to the barricades. Not so. In real life, some of the worst conflicts are precisely the conflicts between two victims of the same oppressor. Mm. Two children of the same violent parent don't love one another. They say, you are exactly like him. No, you are exactly like him. And this is precisely what happens between Jew and Arab in the Middle East. Each one of them looks at the other and sees his incarnation of the past oppressor of Europe.
And do you think it's getting worse now? Or is that the sort of intensity of those feelings, is that even more intense?
It is intense. I don't know if it's becoming more intense, but it is intense.
Let me quote something else, and this was looks like it was in Newsweek two years ago. Picking up on this, you said the Arabs look at us as Israelis and can't see who we really are, a bunch of half-hysterical refugees and survivors. What they see is an extension of the white, oppressive, sophisticated, colonializing Europe, pressing and humiliating the Arabs. You said this in 1992. We Israelis, on the other hand, look at the Arabs as nothing but the incarnation of our past oppressors, Cossacks, pogrom makers, Nazis. They have grown mustaches this time and wrapped themselves in kefiyas, but they are still out there doing the same old thing, cut Jewish throats. Just, this is 20 years ago that you wrote that. The kind of, as you say, people that had the same oppressors but view each other in those graphic terms.
Those stereotypes still exist on both sides.
Yeah. Do you have any... And I know that you are a supporter of a two-state solution. This is something that you have said for decades now. Yeah. Do you think that you're any closer to that today?
Well, yes. I think the good news, which you don't often hear in America, the good news is that the majority of the Palestinians and the majority of the Israeli Jews have reached the conclusion that a two-state solution is unavoidable. Will they be dancing in the streets when the two-state solution is implemented? They will not be dancing in the streets. Do they like this solution? They don't like it, but they know it. They know it in Israel. They know it in Palestine. All we need now is a courageous leadership to carry out something which everybody knows has to be done.
In fact, you said, I'm quoting you again, the patient is ready for surgery. The surgeons are cowards.
Yeah. The surgeons, meaning the leaders. Why are they cowards? You have to ask them, not me.
But you're saying the patient is ready for surgery.
Yes.
The idea is that...
Unhappily ready for the surgery. Right. The patient being the Israelis and the Palestinians.
So what would move these surgeons, these leaders along, do you think?
We need courageous leadership, the type of leadership which Israel and Egypt had in the days of Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin, when the two of them were ready to break some taboos and do something that had never been done before and make peace between Israel and Egypt. The same can happen between Israel and the Palestinians if the leaders on both sides have the courage to break the taboos.
Do you think it requires different leaders, or do you think these leaders can be, moved to that position?
I frankly don't know. Uh-huh. Human nature is open-ended. People are capable of surprising others and even of surprising themselves. Who would have thought that Gorbachev, of all people, will dismantle the Soviet Union? Who would have thought that De Gaulle will take France out of Algiers? So we don't know. We never know.
What don't we know in this country, though, about what's going on in Israel and in Gaza, the West Bank? What don't we know?
Well, you don't know the simple reality that the majority of the Israelis are not religious fanatics and not West Bank settlers. To judge by Israel as reflected on the West Bank, you would think that 80% are zealots, 19% are ruthless soldiers in the roadblocks, and 1% are wonderful intellectuals like myself who criticize the government and struggle for peace. This is not Israel. 70 or 80% of the Israelis are secular to the bone, hedonistic, noisy, passionate, middle class, argumentative, warm-hearted, and they live on the coastal plain. We Israelis belong in a Fellini movie, not in an Ingmar Bergman film.
Where everyone is in despair and, you know, the wheat, right?
If you promise to take the following with a big grain of salt, I'll tell you that Israel is neither a nation nor a country. It's a fiery collection of arguments. 8 million citizens, 8 million prime ministers, 8 million prophets and messiahs.
And we shouldn't be surprised about that, right?
No.
A country of Jewish people that what
else do you expect?
But in a Fellini movie, though, in an Italian movie.
Everybody shouts at the top of their voices. No one ever listens except for me. I listen sometimes. That's how I make a living.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talking with Amos Oz today on Radio Times. He's written 27 books, including fiction, nonfiction, a memoir. He's written books for children as well. And he has opinions on just about everything. And we are talking about writing and fiction and, of course, the Middle East as well. Let me get Paul from Center City, Philadelphia, to join our conversation. And, Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you very much.
You're
it's a real honor. And you're doing a fantastic interview right from the start.
Thank you so much.
I was going to ask whether Mr. Oz thought that there was any type of breakthrough that could happen, as kind of happened here in the United States during the 60s, where some of that hatefulness in the South, in the segregation and all that stuff, was kind of broken through by Kennedy and by the musicians and the artists at the time, whether that type of thing, poetry, art, music, could have some unifying and pacifying effect. But then I started thinking about the despair and the fact that no matter what, Israel is sandwiched between Gaza and the West Bank. And is that a cause of despair? And is that something that is like an additional mountain to have to climb?
Well, Paul, thanks for the call. Yes, go ahead.
It's a cause for edginess. The Israelis are edgy. They are nervous and restless and untrusting, very untrusting. But yes, there is a chance for a breakthrough, and as I said earlier, it all depends on bold and courageous leadership on both sides, and it has to be on both sides simultaneously at the same time. Everybody knows that the solution is two states and mutual recognition. Everybody even knows more or less where the boundaries will be. Everybody even knows that Jerusalem will be the capital city of the two states. What we need now is leaders who can carry out the surgery, which everybody knows, the patient knows, is unavoidable.
You have written, and actually I'm looking at something you wrote about Israel's tent city. There were protests in Israel about, I guess, the economy, the standard of living, the high price of housing, something that's going on in this country as well. Do you see that as a kind of a turning point in Israel?
It's too early to say, but it might be a turning point. Mind you, 500,000 Israelis marched in the streets of Tel Aviv in protest. 500,000 Israelis, it is the equivalent of 25 million Americans. Bear this in mind. It was a huge demonstration.
Yeah.
And yet, amazingly non-violent. There was not a single episode of violence, either on the side of the protesters or on the side of the police. But yes, it may be a beginning of a turning point. Mm. It's too early to tell.
You spent some time on a kibbutz.
Yes.
As you have described, you weren't very good at picking crops, I guess, or doing the work of the kibbutz. Is that a fair description of your time?
No, it's not. I was a very good cotton picker. I was a very good farmer.
I'm sorry.
But they gave me days off for writing. They gave me days off for writing, provided I worked twice as hard on the remaining days. And for me, it was a creeping annexation for time for writing. Of course, all my royalties and all my incomes went to the communal treasury. But it was, for me, one of the most crucial experiences in my life, my 30 years in a kibbutz.
because of the community life, because of the kind of idealism, I'm assuming, the hard work, the idealism that comes from that
kind of
community?
Because I had the chance to get to know a small community of 450 people inside out. I knew all their secrets. I knew all about them. I knew the gossip. I have seen the genetics at work. Of course, the penalty I was made to pay is that they knew a hell of a lot more about me than I wanted them to know, but that was only fair.
But that's village life, yeah, is it not?
That's,
I mean,
village
in certain
life.
Ways, this,
yes,
some of what we learn in this book may be also from your experience in the kibbutz.
May well be.
Yeah. But you were allowed a day off to write?
First a day off, then 2 days off. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, when I became a source of income to the community, 3 days off every week.
And so is that when you became a writer?
No, I became a writer much earlier. I became a writer as soon as they taught me the alphabet, and perhaps even before that, mm-hmm, when I was inventing little stories and telling my friends. That was my way of impressing the girls. I had no other way of impressing them but inventing stories.
Well, girls are impressed by stories.
Some are.
Exactly. Yes. Let me get to Erica from Bethlehem to join us on Radio Times. Erica, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have to tell you, I'm driving right now, and I'm listening to your story, and I lived in Israel for 1 year. I was a year course student, and the experience absolutely changed my life. And I went there as a Zionist, as a very proud Jew, as, you know, very naive in a sense. I was 17. I didn't know any Hebrew. I didn't know what it was like in Israel. I had no idea, even though I was bat mitzvah there years before. And I came back sort of hardened in that way of how you describe Israelis. And I really had a feeling of anger towards America. Mm. And I'm wondering if you can sort of describe what you think. I have so many questions for you, but I'm wondering what you think America's role should be in this two-state concept.
Erica, thanks for the call. Yes, go ahead.
I think America should endorse the two-state solution, as it actually does. The Obama administration endorsed the two-state solution and tried to enhance it and promote it. And I think both America and Israel should seriously and earnestly work for an historical compromise between Israelis and Palestinians. And I believe such a compromise is obtainable.
And just the sort of hard work, does more pressure need to be applied, more threats? I mean, they're
it's all not about threats. It's about the need to reassure the Israelis that if they give back the occupied territories, if they give back the West Bank, they will not be taking suicidal risks. Mm. So it's not enough to pressure Israel or to threaten Israel. It's also necessary to reassure Israel and to reassure the Palestinians, to reassure both sides. And America can play a very important reassuring role for both.
But it must be frustrating, as you say, and that everyone sort of knows, yeah, in their heart of heart, yeah, what the solution, yeah, is. The problem is convincing people to get there.
Yeah. Well, but that's precisely what leadership is about. Mm-hmm. Harry S. Truman once said that to be a leader means to persuade people to do something which in their heart of hearts they know they have to do, but they don't want to.
Mm-hmm. Where do you live now in Israel?
I live in a small town, small desert town called Arad, not far from the Dead Sea.
What is it look like? What kind of town is it?
It's a small town, 27,000 strong, but very cosmopolitan. We have Ethiopians and Sudanese, Russians and Latin Americans, Europeans and Americans, Orthodox Jews, secular Jews. So it's a microcosm.
Mm. And how do you spend, I mean, do you write every day? Do you?
Yes, I have a working routine. I get up very early in the morning. I'm an early riser.
How early?
Five. I take a brisk walk in the desert for half an hour. I drink a cup of coffee. I sit myself by my desk and I start asking myself, what if I were him? What if I were her? That's what I do for a living.
You do that every day?
Every day.
Without fail?
Every single day without fail, oh, yes. Yes.
And
I don't produce every day. There are good days and bad days. But I sit by my desk every day and wait.
And are you done at a certain time? I mean, obviously you get up at 5. Do you say, well, by 3 o'clock I'm done today? Or
I take a break for lunch. I take a siesta. And in the afternoon I go back to my basement study to destroy what I've written in the morning.
Is that true?
Sometimes, yes.
So you do the work up here and then you destroy it in the basement. Is that what that digging is all about in your book?
This is your interpretation.
But as you said, you struggle over every word. Does that mean it's painful?
It's painful because the language is limited. Mm-hmm. For example, if you want to describe with precision a certain flavor, a certain odor, a certain smell, there are just not enough words in the language for all the huge variety of flavors and odors and smells. So you struggle to find some simile or some metaphor. Mm-hmm. And this is a harsh struggle.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know, in Hebrew, I assume you write in Hebrew.
Yes.
I mean, English, there are a lot of words. Hebrew, it just doesn't feel like there are enough words?
Well, there's
Or you've not, used them all up?
There are not enough words in any language.
Coming from a writer, right?
Yeah.
Are you working on something?
I'm always working on something, but I'm reluctant to expose my pregnancy to x-rays. It's not good for the baby.
And you're on a book tour, which means what, you have to put that life on hold?
Yes, I have to put my writing on hold, although in my head I'm writing all the time.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's been such a pleasure. And thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Malti. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Amos Oz is our guest today on Radio Times, and he is the author of some 27 books, and he's got a new book, a collection of stories put together in a small novel. It's called Scenes from Village Life. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. We've got Facebook and Twitter and email archives, and you can certainly check us out online. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.